Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, best-selling author Homer Hickam, talking about his latest book, a lovely memoir recalling the early days of his parents' marriage in somewhat fanciful form. And in part two of the program, some words about forgiveness. Stay with us. I suspect that many of you are well acquainted with the name of Homer Hickam, a very, very gifted writer and someone who has lived a most intriguing life. And, of course, he is probably best known for his New York Times best-selling memoir called Rocket Boys, adapted into a beautiful film called October Sky, which recounted Homer Hickam's growing up in a small coal mining community. And in those somewhat unpromising circumstances, became fascinated with rockets and grew up to enjoy a career in the field. And, of course, has gone on to do all kinds of other intriguing things as well, including a very wide-ranging and successful career as a writer. His most recent novel is called Carrying Albert Home, the somewhat true story of a man, his wife, and her alligator. The man and wife mentioned in the subtitle happen to be Homer Hickam's father and mother. But the story is a fanciful one, an imaginative one, but certainly based in a great deal of truth as well. And for the next few minutes, we're going to be talking with Homer Hickam about this very, very interesting and entertaining and poignant novel published by William Morrow. Again, it's called Carrying Albert Home. Homer Hickam, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, Greg, thank you for having me on. I really do appreciate it. Like you were recalling that book, Rocket Boys, I wrote that about 20 years ago, and golly, it sold millions upon millions of copies, and they made that movie. And it was that movie that actually ultimately led to me writing Carrying Albert Home because, when you ask an author about a movie based on his book, it's sort of like asking a cow how he feels about the slaughterhouse. So, but in that movie, I thought they mischaracterized, for folks who hadn't read the book, they mischaracterized my parents. You know, my father was this dour, mean old guy, and mom was this kind of a wimpy little housewife, and nothing could have been farther from the truth.
Hmm.
I started telling them, yeah, my mom was a liberated woman long before her time, and my dad was kind of a quiet intellectual, so I started telling the story about Albert the Alligator to kind of let people know who they really were. You know, my mom, she got out of the coal fields just as soon as she could back in 1929 when she graduated from high school and got herself on down to Florida. And down there, she met this young man named Buddy Ebsen. He later became Uncle Jed and the Beverly Hillbillies and all that. And they fell in love with each other. And then Buddy went off to Hollywood, and Elsie, my mom, went back to the coal fields, ended up marrying my dad, Homer Sr., and Buddy sent her as a wedding present a baby alligator. And she fell in love with that alligator, and my father was afraid of it and also jealous of it, and it chased him out in the yard one day, and he started yelling, "All right, Elsie, it's me or this alligator." And after a few days of thinking it over, Elsie said, "Well, all right, I'll let Albert go, but we have to carry him home." And so this is the story of how Homer Sr. and Elsie, my parents before they were my parents, took this road trip. It was a family legend from West Virginia to Florida. And a lot of folks say, you know, it reminds them of Big Fish or The Notebook, Life of Pi. I think it's kind of original. I'm starting a whole new genre here called the family legend genre.
Right. So what you have just recounted to us, all of that is factually true.
That part, Greg, all of this book is true except for the parts that are not, and they're true too. You know, you know, when families used to sit around and talk around the kitchen table and tell stories about their family, and this is what I was this is what we did in my family as well. So whenever you told a story about Uncle Hank or Aunt Mary or so on, you did it, you know, for a reason, and not necessarily that it was completely 100% factually true. It might have just been funny, but the underlying part of the story was that you were trying to teach the kids or whoever listening to the story something about that person. And so carrying Albert home for folks who've read Rocket Boys, or even if they haven't, this is about a young couple that you're going to learn an awful lot about, and it's really for people who are in love or have been in love or want to be in love or maybe lost a love. It's a story ultimately of how two people discovered love while traveling to Florida with an alligator in the back seat of their car.
And of course, one of the most intriguing things about this story, even apart from the whole alligator thing and the Buddy Epson thing, is the fact that your mother and your father were very different from one another. And so this is a story also of love springing up in a relationship that at a glance might seem at least somewhat unlikely or unpromising.
Well, yeah, you know, in a way it's the story of a classic love triangle. Homer loves Elsie, Elsie loves Albert. The difference is, well, it's kind of green and scaly. Albert is an alligator. And so, yeah, along the way, they are very different. It's pretty clear once you get into the novel that Elsie has no intention of going back to the coal fields where they're starting from. As a matter of fact, she's just not sure she should be in this marriage. She's got so many ambitions for her life, and it's certainly not to be a coal miner's wife. Homer can't figure out how to get her to love him. All he knows is that he's doing this thing for her. He's carrying her alligator back to Florida. And whatever happens along the way, maybe he can convince her to fall in love with him. And she hopes maybe she can convince him not to ever go back to West Virginia. So they've got this conflict right off the bat. But so many things, I mean, it's a disaster all the way. I mean, right off the bat, Homer and Albert accidentally rob a bank. And then Elsie falls in with moonshiners on the Thunder Road while Homer ends up with a serial killer. And they end up in a Tarzan movie down in Florida. I mean, all these things were told to me over many, many years. But when I put it all together, when I put it in sequential order, I realized I was getting a message from my parents, really, from heaven, which is where I suspect they are, I hope they are, that was telling me how they stayed together over 60 years and actually never agreed on anything, as far as I can tell.
So, let's reintroduce you. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author Homer Hickam and talking with him about his most recent book, a novel based, though heavily on some real-life experiences, a novel called Carrying Albert Home, the somewhat true story of a man, his wife, and her alligator. I'm so glad you said what you did at the top of the interview about how the film based on your childhood, October Sky, which I think at least to some extent you think is a lovely film, one thing it got wrong was your parents. And I can understand and I appreciate you saying that, because if your father was indeed how he was portrayed in that film, as an extremely taciturn and pretty sour guy, I can't imagine him ever opening up to you and sharing any of these sides of him that that you then share with us in this novel. That being said, it's still difficult to turn the clock back and paint a vivid picture of your father years before you were even born. Talk about that challenge, and of course that challenge is there with your mother as well, your mother Elsie. How did you paint such rich portraits of them at a point in life when you weren't yet on the scene?
Yeah, I was quite a few years in the future. We were 23 years old when they made this this great trip from West Virginia to Florida. What happened was that I discovered the truth about, about Albert when in 1955 when I was watching the Davy Crockett Show, and on there the fellow playing Davy Crockett's best buddy was they called him Georgie Russell, but it was actually Buddy Ebsen. And my mom came in from the kitchen and said, "I knew him," and walked out, and I thought, my gosh, I knew she was old, but I didn't know she knew Davy Crockett. But when I followed her into the kitchen, she said, "Yeah, I knew him back in Florida, and Buddy Ebsen, and he gave me Albert." And I said, "Well, who's Albert?" And she said, "Well, he was an alligator. I never told you about Albert." And I said, "No, ma'am." And that started her telling me about their great journey, road trip from West Virginia to Florida. And in his to defend himself over the years, my father would also give his version of these crazy tales that my mom was telling about what happened. And so that was an opportunity for me to share with my father, who generally was at work up at the coal mine. But little asides, like for instance, when I was headed off to Vietnam, I called home and I got my dad. The mom was out. And Dad knew that I was headed for a rough place. So he started telling me the time when they were carrying Albert home when he was temporarily working for the railroad from Miami to Key West. And down there they met Ernest Hemingway and got caught in the great hurricane of 1935. And he was basically telling me how he survived that. And by keeping his eyes open and always trying to be one step ahead of danger. And so he was giving me a message about going to Vietnam and paying attention over there and always trying to think one step ahead of what might happen. So along the way, as they told these stories, they told them for a reason, but it was up to me then to put them in sequential order when I decided to write the novel based on these tales. And I realized really what it all added up to. They were telling me how it was that they were actually in love, even though mostly what I heard was them disagreeing over the years.
Right. And, of course, one of the biggest points of disagreement, we've touched on this already, is the fact that life in this little coal mining community was not the life that your mother Elsie had ever envisioned. One of the chapters of your book opens with these words: "Every morning when Elsie blinked awake, she was always a little surprised to find herself a coal miner's wife." What was most sort of bewildering about life as a coal miner's wife?
My mom was so smart. She was so artistic. She had so much ability, and there she was stuck in this little town, Colwood, a coal miner's wife. And she didn't have, frankly, a whole lot in common with the other coal miners' wives. So she was very attentive to her second son. That would be me. I was kind of a nerdy little guy, and she had me reading when I was 4 years old and encouraging me to be all I could be. She really, really wanted me to be a writer, and ultimately that's what I ended up being. She really liked that. But she had so many ambitions, she just really couldn't figure out what it was that she could do there in Colwood. But she always just fell back, I think, on this grand adventure that she and my father had when they were 23 years old, where through almost everything that happened, it seemed like it was a disaster. But they managed to get out of it, whatever it was, and she was able to reflect on that Homer Sr. had saved her a number of times during all of these crazy adventures that they had, and that clearly because he was willing to put an alligator in the back seat, a friendly little alligator, by the way, he was a funny little boy, but he was willing to do that and actually leave his job there in Colwood, which he dearly loved. He loved the town, he loved his job. He was willing to take the chance to put Elsie, an unhappy wife, in the passenger seat, an alligator in the back seat, and for reasons that we're still not sure why, but there was a rooster also along on this trip in this old 1925 Buick. He was willing to do that. He was willing to carry Albert home for Elsie, and Elsie never forgot that. And she appreciated that across her whole life. And it was my pleasure and my opportunity to tell this story for everyone, you know, especially for people, I think for people, again, who are in love or want to be in love or maybe have lost a love, this is a story that that they're going to be able to sit down, maybe sometimes with a heavy heart, and they're going to get a lot of laughs out of this story. But when they rise after reading it, I think their heart is going to be really lightened because they know that even if it takes putting an alligator in the back seat and lighting out for Florida, hey, this life is a pretty good one.
One of the most surprising turns in this novel is full of them, is when your parents in North Carolina encounter some radicals, and it turns out that there are some ways in which your mother is most sympathetic and in sort of in sync with some of these radicals which they meet. And I think it's especially interesting, you know, when your mother kind of expresses why she's found herself in sync with them. It was, as much as anything, their honesty, their determination to do what they said they were going to do that she really appreciated. Tell us more about this and how much this actually springs from anything that actually occurred in her life.
Well, over the years there in Colwood, my mom was very much on the side of the Union, and I often wondered about that. My father was very much against the Union. And so that the story came out of that. My dad would say, you know, your mom used to be a communist, and Elsie would say, no, I wasn't. I was a radical. There's a subtle but important difference between the two. You got to realize this trip was through the deepest, darkest part of it, the Depression, 1935. They were down in North Carolina, and Homer Sr. got mistaken for a radical himself, the coal miner who was apparently expertise with dynamite, and these radicals down there were striking a sock mill or a textile mill. They wanted to blow it up, and so he got involved with them, trying to get away from them. And by the way, they'd picked up a hitchhiker by the name of John Steinbeck at that point, Elsie was intrigued by them, as you said. They were these radicals, members of what they called the party, you know, the Communist Party. They wanted to organize these textile mills. And so while Homer and John Steinbeck were trying to figure out how to extricate themselves through all of this, Elsie was joining up, and so was Albert. And pretty soon, because the leader of the radicals was a pretty ineffective little guy, Elsie got them all organized. Again, she had all these grand ambitions, and suddenly she thought, maybe that's what I'm meant to be. Maybe I'm meant to be a union organizer. And she gets them organized and leads a strike on this sock mill with somewhat disastrous results.
One of the things that I appreciate, too, is your vivid description of the dust that was everywhere in Colwood, and that, by contrast, just the air itself in a place like Florida was so much more beautiful as far as your mother was concerned, and the smell of honeysuckle. And it really helps us understand how, for somebody who has briefly lived in Florida, how they would long to return there. And, of course, that was something that was true for your mother for many, many years.
Yeah, she longed that for that her entire life. Ultimately, she did manage to retire down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And in the novel, I tell how back in 1935, Homer Sr. and Elsie ended up briefly down there around Merle's Inlet, which is real close by. And Elsie actually ran a boarding house temporarily because they'd gotten all their money stolen. And then Homer went to work on a fishing boat temporarily, and Albert went out as a good luck charm. And then they ended up in the Coast Guard, which is another whole story, fighting smugglers and so on. But, yeah, Elsie back on shore was breathing this fresh air, reminding her of what it was like down in Florida. And she longed for those days. And she often told with some nostalgia about when she ran that little boarding house down there. And, well, I don't want to give away too much, but she kind of met a ghost while she was there. And It was so sad in a way to hear Elsie tell these stories about when she was free for a little while, and that was while they were carrying Albert home.
Right, had tasted that freedom and always wanted it to be more a part of her life than it ultimately was.
Yeah.
It's such a poignant and also entertaining and often hilarious series of stories that we experience in this novel, Carrying Albert Home, The Somewhat True Story of a Man, His Wife, and Her Alligator, published by William Morrow, and the author, Homer Hickam. Homer Hickam, once again, you've given the world a wonderful book, and I am so appreciative of this opportunity to talk with you about it. Best wishes with everything else you write from here on, and thank you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
Part two of today's morning show from the Morning Show Archives is a conversation with one of America's greatest musicians, Wynton Marsalis, reflecting on the importance of listening, the importance of forgiveness, and of course, the power of music, and especially the power of jazz. Stay with us. It is my pleasure and honor to be speaking today with Wynton Marsalis, one of the most familiar names in all of American music, and responsible for a wonderful new book about his musical first love, jazz, a book called Moving to Higher Ground, How Jazz Can Change Your Life, published by Random House. Wynton Marsalis, we welcome you to the morning show.
All right, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really good to be talking to you. The day we're recording this happens to be, I think, the day after you were on Talk of the Nation on NPR. I heard your visit and enjoyed so much of what you had to say. There was a really memorable moment in that time that I want to just talk to you about briefly, where a woman called up and was talking about her own father and his connection with some of the jazz greats that also you talk about in your book. And she really became choked up in thinking about her own father, remembering him, remembering the music he loved so much, and you were so kind to her, and it was a very powerful moment when I think all of us listening were realized, maybe in a new way, just the emotional hold that music has over us and the way in which it connects us to people and things, even from our very distant past. I wonder if you would start out by just talking about that for a moment and how that's been true for you.
She called in, actually, and she was talking about her father in Indianapolis, and in the 50s, he would go to the clubs, and he would check out Wes Montgomery, great guitarist, and she began to get full, and she choked up because she felt that she had let her father down, and she came to an understanding of the music, but when he was alive, she didn't really love the music, and he really loved the music. So I was just explaining to her about people who love jazz and fathers and their kids, that because my father was a jazz musician, and for many years I didn't really like jazz, and it's just you recognize that this is a great music, and what you learn from the music you can put into your kids. It's not necessary for them to like the music or love it, because this music is such an accepting music, and it's so much a music. It was made by people like Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington. They weren't judgmental people. They were happy to be in the world, to have an influence on the world, and the message that they brought was one of freedom, one of love. And ultimately, it's a music that teaches you how to negotiate with other people and how to have respect for the feelings and the creativity of others.
One of my favorite lines in your beautiful book is when you say, "Jazz teaches empathy. You create and nurture a feeling with other people. And it also teaches you to do your own thing. That's a really interesting thing right there, and maybe part of what you talk about elsewhere in the book about how jazz reconciles opposites. It brings together things that maybe on the surface might almost seem contradictory.
Right. Well, you find with a lot of great literature, with a lot of great stories, there's always an opposite that go on. In jazz, through the blues, we start off with opposites. The blues brings together the major and the minor mode. The blues can have sad lyrics, but the groove that's put on it is always happy. And jazz is a music that shows you how a person can be a virtuoso without playing a lot of notes. Or it teaches us so many things about working with each other. Many times in jazz, to get the most powerful effect is silence. Some of our greatest musicians are known for leaving spaces. Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis are two that come most immediately to mind.
You tell us that jazz teaches respect and trust, and that particularly in jazz, musicians always spend more time listening than playing. You point out quite rightly that none of us are as good a listener as we probably could be and should be, and jazz is one means to really appreciate the power and importance of listening.
Right. If I could say that there's one most important tool that jazz and listening to jazz can give a person who's not a musician, it would be the power of listening. Because the music trains you to listen into what someone is playing. It trains you to follow what they're playing. A lot of times what throws us off with the music is that it's not just 3 minutes of something repeated. It goes on and on and on, and there are no words. You have to listen and follow very closely the emotion and the changes, not just in the music of the person who's soloing. Because in jazz, we don't really have a background. The rhythm section is in the background, but it's also the foreground. Because they're playing all the time, the drums and the bass, and they're listening all the time, and they make changes and adjustments, and they're interacting with the soloist. And that dynamic between the soloist, maybe it's a piano player, trumpet player, saxophone player, and the rhythm section, which is the bass and the drums and the piano, or guitar is also sometimes a part of that. That dialogue that goes on between them gives us a clue and can teach us how to be patient and listen and follow and continue to follow.
You have played a lot of classical music over the years and made a lot of stupendous classical recordings, but I think pretty much now you devote yourself to jazz more than that, more than classical playing. What you were talking about just now in terms of the importance of listening, how is that different when you are playing jazz versus playing the Haydn Trumpet Concerto, for instance?
Well, the Haydn Trumpet Concerto hasn't changed since I first played it. The first time I encountered it, I was 13 years old, 14. It's kind of funny. I was listening to it the other day and singing along with all the internal parts. It's still a fantastic piece of music. Haydn was such a genius and a master of the development of theme. But in jazz, you don't know what people are going to play. So it, every moment of music is different. I have no idea what the drummer will play at any given time. I have no idea how a piano player will comp. So with jazz, it's a matter of your reflexes and being able to respond to changes. In that way, jazz is most like democratic living, because things happen. You can't predict them. You have to be ready to respond to them.
As you evoke the word democracy, reminds me of another D word in your book. You say, particularly when it comes to rehearsing a piece of jazz, it requires diplomacy. Talk about diplomacy as it lives in jazz.
Well, I think I tell the story of the great Benny Carter, one of our greatest musicians, architect of the big band, early arranger, a virtuoso on saxophone and trumpet. He won the National Medal of Arts. He won the Kennedy Center Honors. He did so many things. It's a laundry list of accomplishments. He was performing with us, and then at this time he was in his late 80s. So we were in a rehearsal. He didn't like the way that we were playing, so he started to have words with our drummer. And they were going back and forth, kind of, you know, how are you playing? You're not playing it right. So Benny was trying to figure out how he could get him to play what he wanted him to play without insulting him or just telling him what to play and taking the power away, because you don't want to take the power from the drummer. So after a while, he got frustrated, and he just told him, use your own good taste. Use your own good taste. So the use that sentence was an ultimate act of diplomacy, because on one hand, he's telling the drummer he has good taste, and he's implying that he's not perhaps using it, and he's telling him, just use your own good taste. So he's not telling him what to play, but he is telling him what to play.
Right. You're right. That's some delicious diplomacy there. And I'm glad you spoke of good taste. That reminds me of another favorite line from your book, when you say jazz is the most flexible art form ever because it believes in the good taste of individuals. It believes in our ability to make reasonable choices. It takes a chance on our decision-making skills instead of legislating our freedom away with written restrictions and restrictive hierarchies. And I suppose it's especially when somebody plays jazz that they come to really appreciate and understand that most fully. But I suppose even listening to jazz, we can have at least a glimmer of recognition of how important that is.
That's of central importance, trust and belief. And if you're a listener, you function, you exist on belief. If you get someone's album, or if you go out and you decide you're going to spend the night of your time listening to someone's music, that's a trust and a belief. You're taking a leap of faith. I remember once I tried to play different music every time when I traveled around the country. And once I was on a tour playing some music that people didn't really like. So someone came backstage, I think it was in Des Moines, Iowa. I kind of remember where we were, and they said, man, you know, I come to all of your concerts. I've been coming since the early 1980s when you first came out here. But I got to be honest with you. I did not like the music that you all played tonight. But I'm going to be back the next time, because the last four concerts y'all did, I really enjoyed them, and I trust and I have faith that you will change what you're doing. Okay. So that was an example. He was insulting me, but at the same time, he was giving me something. And that's like the trust that the audience has if they follow you. They're not asking you to play the old music you played, or saying, we'll follow you when you do something, but we trust that you're going to give us something that will give us the type of nourishment. You got to meet us somewhere. Huh. And jazz teaches you that you have to meet people somewhere. And to communicate with someone else, you have to meet them somewhere.
Right. Your book is so joyous, and yet you do also talk about anger and injustice. And you say you can't teach the history of jazz without talking in depth about segregation. And your own story is of how jazz did a lot to sort of lead you sort of out of some of your own counterproductive anger. Talk for a moment about the way in which jazz really saved you from that kind of anger, in a sense.
Well, when I grew up, we were the first kind of generation of people that were integrated. I first grew up in complete segregation in Kenner, Brobridge, Louisiana. Then after Martin Luther King was killed, I was like 8 or 9 years old. I went to school an integrated school, kind of was called integration, but like 3 or 4 black kids. That was a totally different experience. And just the experience I had dealing with teachers and with students left me embittered for a very long time. And studying this music, every musician you read about or talk about, their philosophy is always so counter to racism. Louis Armstrong is always talking about the power of people and human beings. Duke Ellington is always talking about that. John Coltrane, I read the book about black nationalism and black music, and you figure this was done in the 60s. It's going to be one of these black power type books. And Coltrane is on the cover of the book. But when they get to his interview, he says, well, my music is not about race of people. It's not about black or separate people. Human beings are all human beings. My music is about love, and it's about people coming together. And that's a universal thought in jazz. And down through the years, I've had the opportunity to meet so many great musicians of all races and talk with them about history, American history, racism, segregation. And I've learned unbelievable lessons about how this music has always demonstrated that we are together, that we can come together, that we should be together, and the great things that we create when we recognize that mutual history.
Hmm. I think one of the most profound things you say in the entire book isn't particularly about jazz. It's in talking about your own embitteredness, as you term it. You said, after I started getting deeper into the music, I realized that anger gives you a certain power It's fuel, but it's costly fuel. It burns quickly and destroys everything around it. And as you get older, if you don't let it go, it burns you up. I think you speak so wisely there. And of course, it gives us a profound appreciation for any kind of experience that lifts someone beyond that. I mean, not leaving all their anger behind, of course, but of finding a way to fully live life without the kind of anger that destroys yourself.
Right. It's easy to cling to your anger because it feels good, and you get used to it. I remember once I was at CBS Records, and it was before it became Sony, and Bill Withers was up there, and he's the guy that made the hit from Lean On Me. And I knew who Bill Withers was. I knew his music, and I knew that he had a rocky relationship with his wife, Denise Nicholas. And Denise Nicholas, and we were kind of against him because we thought, man, how could this man? We all had crushes on her. How could this man be like that toward her, violent toward her? So I knew him, and he came up to me and he said, "Man, I watch you on these interviews, and I know you have a lot of anger in you." He said, "But I'm gonna tell you something. You have to let that anger go because it's gonna kill you before it kills them." He said, "Take it from me. I know, because I've never been able to let go of mine. You're much younger than me. You got a chance. Think about what I'm telling you." And that was the only time I met him or talked with him or encountered him. Hmm. And so that always stuck in my mind, that piece of advice.
Legendary musician Wynton Marsalis, in a conversation out of the WGTD Morning Show archives from a number of years ago, I talked to Wynton Marsalis upon the publication of his book called Moving to Higher Ground, How Jazz Can Change Your Life. We finish out the hour with a third interview excerpt on the topic of forgiveness very directly, a conversation which I recorded actually earlier this year with a British writer by the name of Marina Cantacuzino. Her book called The Forgiveness Project, Stories for a Vengeful Age, in which she shares with the reading public very intriguing and beautiful stories from actually all around the world of various people who have gone on the journey of forgiveness, trying to rise above anger or bitterness over having been hurt or wronged, who have somehow found their way to a place of forgiveness. And the stories are widely varied and very, very moving. Again, this is a conversation with the author and editor of the book, The Forgiveness Project, Marina Cantacuzino.
One of the things you say is that you feel a certain ambivalence about forgiveness, not in the act, the gift, the virtue, but in how we promote and present it and how we encourage others to think about it. And towards that end, you were really anxious in this collection, The Forgiveness Project, to avoid, at least to some extent, a couple of things that you, in a sense, saw as maybe potential pitfalls. One of them is that you did not want these stories, at least by and large, to be too tied to religious faith. I mean, not that there isn't something perfectly legitimate about forgiveness springing from one's own personal faith, but there might be a limitation to how applicable maybe those kind of stories would be to a general public. And you also didn't want these stories to be overly sentimental, that too much is said and written about forgiveness, which is sentimental sometimes to the extreme. Talk about those two concerns and how you ultimately sort of acted on those concerns in the assembling of the Forgiveness Project.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this concept that forgiveness is this magical key to serenity where everything's all right. And also it's very much framed around a religious discourse often. And the words sacred and spirituality are used a lot around the concept of forgiveness, I should say. And I think I really wanted, as a journalist, I'm quite mainstream in my thoughts. And I definitely wanted to make it for people of all faiths and none. I wanted to use a very simple language, not an over-spiritualized language or an over-therapy therapy. I don't know if there's a word, therapized language, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Away from the whole personal development language, I just wanted them to be as real as they could be and authentic as they could be in the voices of the people who told the stories, because I knew from my years of journalism that people really were gripped when you told the real stories of true people, much more than when I had something to say as a journalist or as quoting a politician or an academic or an expert. And I think that's the success of this project. And I think that's why we're still going 11 years, because these stories touch people's hearts, because they're able to not only humanize violence, and by that I don't mean make it more palatable, I mean understand why people harm people, but they also, you know, they're a gift in the sense that people so often tell me that reading the stories or being exposed to these stories in multiple ways that we do it has helped them deal with the pain and the suffering in their own life. Hmm. And I never expected that when I started this work particularly.
You say at one point, if forgiveness was a color, for me it would be gray, the color of compromise and conciliation, and because it sits between the two extremes of black and white. And towards that end, you speak in the book about how certainty is something to which we gravitate. It's something that gives us something to hold on to, and yet it can be a mistake to think in terms of certainty when it comes to something like forgiveness, that at the risk of leaving everything completely vague, you really don't want this to be a book about this is why you should forgive and this is how you should forgive.
Exactly. Yeah, so I stay away from process, because a lot of people offer, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 steps to forgiveness, and they more or less, you know, talk about the same aspects. And yes, they're all in the story somewhere. But I think there's lots of interesting work that's been done with academics, researchers, practitioners out there. So I didn't want to repeat. I really just wanted to hold out the stories and put them there as a place of inquiry so that people could, you know, maybe map their own journeys against it, or just learn, or just be interested even, or just think. Shifting of perspective is really what I think it's about. It's having a, forgiveness is all about having a broader perspective, which takes it away from the black and white. And I think increasingly we do live in a world where maybe it's always been the same, but I think black and white rhetoric is very dangerous, because it means, you know, to quote a former president of yours, if you're not with us, you're against us.
As we flip through the heart and soul of the book, which is all of these stories about forgiveness, we see that they come from all over the world, all over the United Kingdom, not surprisingly, but places like Chechnya and Canada and Lebanon and Australia and South Africa. I wonder, as you gathered these stories from these far-flung places, did you come to see forgiveness being acted out in these different places, in these different cultures, in different ways? Or ultimately, did you come to see forgiveness being a very, in a sense, universal concept, even if person to person or situation to situation, they're different? But did you see a lot in the way of cultural differences, or not so much?
Basically, the journey of forgiveness, I think, is a universal one, and it's a human one. But I saw a difference in people's attitudes to the word forgiveness. So, for instance, Jewish people don't tend to use it. And many Africans, it's something that they aspire towards. It's an intention from the beginning. I think many Christian peoples, it might be an intention there from the beginning. But the essential, the human journey is the same the world over, I think. I mean, obviously, there are some cases where there are people who will not entertain it because of the way they've been brought up or the religion that they adhere to. But I think that those differences are in every country. And of course, I'm not, and if you've read the introduction, you'll know that I'm very clear, I'm no expert. It's pretty much, it's not scientific. The, they're a pretty random collection of stories. So I'm really talking to you from a position of a journalist who has just been immersed in this subject for 11 years.
Hmm. Well, and your own journey has been a really intriguing one. Last quick question, if I may. You quote somebody named John Patton, or somebody else quotes them,
yes,
actually, with a really intriguing line. Forgiveness is not something that is done, but something that is discovered. I wonder if you have a thought about those really intriguing words and how the Forgiveness Project maybe folds into that notion.
Yeah, I think why I really like that quote is that it is a journey and an adventure, and people don't know what they're heading towards. And very often it's a lifeline, and people go towards forgiveness because they've tried everything else and nothing else works, or they meet something and it really ignites something inside of them, a new way of thinking or a new way of feeling. And I think the thing that's discovered is that the person who's hurt you is human like you. That's what's discovered. So it's really, it's compassion and empathy are actually really important parts of the forgiveness process. It's more than letting go. It's more than acceptance. It's about humanizing the other.
Marinta Kantakazina, and she has overseen something called the Forgiveness Project and edited this most intriguing book called The Forgiveness Project, Stories for a Vengeful Age. Tomorrow on the morning show, I am looking forward to welcoming back into our studios James Schatzman, who is the artistic director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. And he's going to be in our studios to talk about their upcoming performance of one of the most beautiful and moving of modern cantatas called The Cry. On Thursday, you'll hear my conversation with Stuart Stevens, whose new memoir is called The Last Season. In it, he recounts the really touching story of reconnecting with his own elderly father around something which both of them love very, very much, Ole Miss football. And the book is about how fiercely ferocious the fans of the University of Mississippi are when it comes to their very fine school's football team and its tradition. But it's also a very personal story of these two men coming together around this mutual love. And on Friday's morning show, we're going to be speaking with several different people involved in the upcoming Lakeside Players production of one of the great masterworks from the screen brought to the stage, which of course began life as a superb novel. I'm of course talking about To Kill a Mockingbird. And we'll talk to the director of the production and several different actors. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Our forecast today is for cloudy, windy conditions with rain developing this afternoon. The front coming in, actually the remnants of Hurricane Patricia. High today of 58 degrees. Cloudy, windy, and rainy tonight with a low of 48 degrees. And cloudy, windy tomorrow with a 70% chance of rain with a high of 55.